From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Pinole, California.
Santa Clara.
I'm from Fremont.
Pacifica, California.
Pleasanton.
From Vallejo.
Me from Antioch.
Coming up, the Bay Area responds to the mass shooting in Orlando.
In the spirit of Harvey Milk, we shine our light to guide this path towards healing.
And we hear from a 2016 Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist about drawing in the digital age.
A lot of people will look at the cartoon on their phone, so it has to kind of pop.
Then we'll join a reporter inside San Quentin, where ex-pimps are tackling sex trafficking.
Part of that responsibility we have as offenders is to use that knowledge to prevent future such crimes.
That's today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. The shooting at an LGBTQ club in Orlando, Florida over the weekend shocked the world, hitting especially hard here in the Bay Area. Last night, thousands gathered in San Francisco's Castro District to mourn.
Thank you for standing bravely with Orlando, with our community, and with people around the world whose hearts break open with grief tonight. That is why, my brothers and sisters, here and now, in the spirit of Harvey Milk, we shine our light to guide this path towards healing. Hatred will not drive out hatred. Darkness will not drive out darkness. And as Martin Luther King has always taught us, only love can drive out hatred and darkness.
Across the bay at Oakland City Hall, organizers of Oakland Pride convened a community vigil.
For many families in Florida, they were not aware that their sons were in the club last night. As you may know, we Latinos are very hard with our gay men. Latinos are very afraid to come out of their closet in fear to lose their community and their families. In fear to lose their loved ones. Some of these men were undocumented, so their families may not be able to come and support them or be present for them or be able to bury them. It is hard to be a minority within a minority.
It was once upon a time that I was told, and this was before my time, that in our clubs we used to black out the windows so that people wouldn't see who was going in and who was going out. We used the back door. We are not using the goddamn back door anymore.
Those were the voices of Alejandra Gavila and Amber Todd. They were joined by Yvette Flunder, presiding bishop at the City of Refuge United Church of Christ in San Francisco.
And we are survivors. If you are a survivor, would you tell somebody, I'm a survivor? There's a song that I love. It's not a song of the church. It's a good secular song. It says, once I was afraid. I was petrified, but I made a decision that I'll no longer be afraid, and I'll no longer be petrified, because we are survivors. We have survived murders, evictions, we've been disfellowshipped by religion, we've lost our jobs, we had a woefully slow response to AIDS. Once we were afraid, and we were petrified. But we survived. Tell somebody on the other side, I survived. And now we lead in government, in business, in service, and in faith. And to the members of our community that are leaving the fight, let me say it again, to the members of our community that are leaving the fight to the rest of us, just this, my beloved, ain't no down low justice workers. We're in it to win it, and we have to do it together. We will have to show up for one another. And so we will continue to fight for a world without racism, a fair justice system, equality for all. Hatred killed many of our LGBT family. But pain and loss makes us stronger. Can I give you my personal testimony? Yes. The more I have struggled, the stronger I have become. Yes. And I declare that if you can be strong in religion, you can be strong anywhere. Yes. One more thing. Killing the messengers only makes the message greater. Yes. When Martin Luther King was killed, somebody thought that when you kill the messenger, you kill the message. That was a huge mistake. Because the message got greater and greater and greater. So here's my word to you. Go to all the pride parades here. And wear your stuff. And make your voice loud. And declare that we shall not be moved.
Not be moved.
I will survive.
I will survive.
Did you think I'd crumble? Did you think I'd lay down and die? I will survive. Tell somebody else, I will. We will survive. God bless you.
That was Presiding Bishop Yvette Flunder of the City of Refuge United Church in San Francisco. She spoke last night at a vigil outside Oakland City Hall. The sounds and voices you heard were recorded by KALW's Allison Levitsky and Susan Pollard of the Bay Area News Group. If you'd like to share your thoughts, please do at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. When events like last weekend's mass shooting make the headlines, it can be hard to make sense of such tragedy. And oftentimes, we'll look outside of ourselves to get the perspective we need. Jack Oman helps frame times like these in his artwork. He's the editorial cartoonist for the Sacramento Bee and this year's winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Editorial Cartooning. He's covered everything from the California drought to gun control to hostage crises. KALW's Angela Johnston spoke with Oman about his craft.
How would you describe your role as a journalist?
Well, my role is as a journalist is similar to the role of a, you know, not as a reporter, but as an opinion writer. I think that we're more effective in some ways than columnists because, you know, we can say almost anything we want, and columnists have to couch sometimes. And they also had the luxury, or not the luxury, they had the, cartoonists had the advantage of not having to report. You know, it just has to be factually based, but it's an exaggeration. And if a columnist wrote what a cartoonist draws, they wouldn't be columnists for very long. So it's a difficult kind of line to surf. I mean, I think my role is, you know, as a commentator first, definitely, and then to a lesser extent, your entertainment. You know, you're a light spot on the paper, or you're an accessible spot on the paper. And it's something, nobody skips over cartoons. I mean, that when you go to the New Yorker, you look at every single cartoon. And so this is kind of what I don't get about other daily newspapers. Some of them is like, you know, people like cartoons and people read, they will read cartoons. That's why advertisers put cartoons in their advertisement.
Walk me through your process. How you come up with an idea?
Well, I get up quite early and I do a lot of reading. And the thing that you have to remember about political cartooning is it is not a drawing job. It's a writing job. And so what I'm trying to do is figure out the topic. Once I've got the topic, then I need to get the idea and rough it out in pencil. And then once I've got that, I show it to my editor. And then once I've got that done, then I put it on a light table and ink it up. And then I run it into Photoshop. So that's the process. And it usually takes about 5 hours start to finish.
Okay, so you got this job at the college paper, and then did it just stick from there?
Well, I enjoyed it, and I had a knack for it. And so I started sending my cartoons out to other magazines and newspapers. And the first cartoon I ever sent to Newsweek, they reprinted.
D- Do you remember, well, I guess I'm sure you do, what was that first cartoon that you got published by Newsweek?
Of course I remember it. I have it framed. I mean, it was on the Iranian hostage crisis, and I'm sure in retrospect it would look a little jingoistic, but you have to look back on it at the time, and it was a very, you know, I thought it was going to get drafted.
Can you describe it's hard to, on the radio to describe these things, but what the
cartoon was? I mean, it was the American flag is a doormat with dirt on it, and, you know, it was at the Iranian embassy, and it says, please use doormat.
Okay.
So it's extremely demanding. I mean, it's easy to do a stupid cartoon. It's hard to do a smart cartoon. And, you know, I have a very sophisticated audience in Sacramento. I mean, you can't just run something, you know, stupid by them. They're very the sharpest people in American politics in some ways at a state level. And so I don't try to pitch down to my audience in Sacramento or California because, you know, at this point I think about who's really reading the paper. I don't know that it's that much of a mass market product so much like it was 50 years ago. So I'm very conscious of not dumbing down my product.
What's the role of a political cartoonist in 2016 and how has it changed since you started out?
It's the same role. It's been the same role for several hundred years. You know, the role is, you know, entertainment. The role is enlightenment. The role is amusement. It's an adjunct to editorials. It's not a replacement for editorials in any way.
So your role, you'd say, has stayed pretty much the same. It hasn't.
It's exactly the same. I mean, it would be easier, you know, if you were a New Yorker cartoonist, you could say, it's just to be funny. You know, that's it. But, I mean, I have multiple roles. And so if you go through my Pulitzer portfolio, you go through all the work I've done. New Yorker cartoonists generally aren't doing cartoons about guns. They're not doing cartoons about mass murders. They're not doing cartoons about, you know, the Confederate flag. They're not taking on hard subject matter. They're doing people on desert islands, they're doing people in restaurants, they're doing people sitting at bars, they're doing talking dogs. Of course, I'm doing a talking dog too. But so it's not like we're not in the same business, but we're kind of not in the same business. And so the role is the same. And, you know, a good political cartoon can really knock you out. I mean, in a way that an editorial can't or a news program can't, because you can show it to somebody. I mean, my kids are all in their 20s, and I can't tell you how many times, they'll shove their iPhone at me and say, look at this video, you know, and it's like 90 seconds or 2 minutes, and it's hilarious, but like a cartoon is like 8 seconds. And you can, you know, I can shove their phone in my face and, you know, or shove my phone in their face and say, look, here's, you know, a cartoon. But it used to be, you know, you could, and you can still do, you know, put your cartoon up on the wall. You can put it in your workspace. You can print it out. You can do, you know, you can show it to somebody on your phone. So there's a lot of different, you know, delivery devices.
That was editorial cartoonist Jack Oman speaking with KELW's Angela Johnston. You can find links to Oman's work at KELW.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. People like Jack Oman address difficult issues from their own perspective. Even more intimate, drawing from your own personal experience. That's what inmates at San Quentin are doing in this story from the San Quentin Prison Report.
The San Quentin Prison Report.
Bringing you hidden stories from life inside.
In order to make something grow, you gotta own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free, I like to move about the land.
You can hear a pin drop.
Inside prison walls, former pimps are working to educate people on how to fight illegal sex trafficking. The project is called STEP, Sex Trafficking Exploitation Prevention, started by an ex-pimp and a San Quentin volunteer. From San Quentin Prison, reporter Lewis A. Scott has the story.
The STEP project was started by Kathleen Jackson, a longtime San Quentin volunteer, and myself, Lewis A. Scott. I was a pimp, and I've chosen to share my knowledge of the life with the members of STEP in order to combat this crisis that is currently plaguing our communities. Myself and the members of STEP have created PSAs, training videos on prevention, and we also hold public forums to educate community activists on sex trafficking exploitation prevention.
The slogan that we've had in this project, which is to speak up and speak out, and that not only applies to victims, but it applies to those of us that have been offenders.
Miguel C. Fuentes, a member of STEP, says that to have empathy for others, we have to have empathy for ourselves. Once we begin to suffer the consequences of our crime, we begin to fully understand the harm we've caused others.
Not just the glamorizing of the lifestyle of the pimp, but also the effects on the victim.
Harry Smith, a member of STEP, was a college student when he got pulled into the life. As an ex-pimp, he admits that it's very vicious and cutthroat. There are tactics and schemes that you have to use in order to control and install fear into your victims.
I mean, you do whatever you can to exemplify being a god to her and being her only source. Conversations orientated around trying to divide her from her family, to make her feel like she's nothing, nobody loves her.
Harry Smith did not grow up around the life, but for Daquan Moffitt, who is not a member of STEP, he grew up around it, and he has a clear understanding of what it entails.
My name is Daquan Moffitt, and I'm 18 years old. I come from that era, so I know a little bit of something, you feel me? You want me to be real with it, man? I got family members as pimps. The youngest female I ever seen out there was a 13-year-old, trying to do her little thing. You feel me? She was hoeing. She got to do what her pimp told her to do. And if she don't do that, then it's cookies, you feel me?
When he says cookies, he's talking about discipline. And there are many forms of brutality that is inflicted upon those victimized by traffickers.
So she can either get her ass beat, you feel me, or she ain't going to get something. She ain't going to be able to get her clothes. She ain't going to be able to get nothing to eat until she go out there and bust her move. She not going to be able to go see her family member. That's out.
One who doesn't have, like, any family ties. That's the best one.
We will address this individual as Ramon. He didn't want to give us his name because he wanted to keep his reputation intact amongst his peers.
Like, most of the girls are naive, so you use that, for instance. And if you got charm or if they seem to like you, you feed off that also. And you will hit her with certain spills like, I want us to get some money. Like, I can see bigger and better things. You just use stuff like that, just make up stuff. Sell them a dream, basically.
Here's an example of Ramon's charm. Imagine your teenage daughter or son being captivated by his manipulative words.
Your beauty is beyond comprehension. I like what I see, and I can tell, like, it's some intellect about yourself. And I would like for us to come together with the minds, see what we can make work.
Ramon's not the only one who has a way with words.
I'm a pimp. I rest and dress, eat cake, sleep late.
William Hearns, he's not a member of STEP. He's a pimp. A prime example of how far the generational gap spreads between those that participate in the life.
I'm 59 years old. They can let me out here in there tomorrow. But if I give me a young girl, says she's ready to run and go, because I'm going, because I'm fly. And I know they still like me because I'm still fly. But you think I'm going to turn down some money if you give it to me? No.
He has been in life since he was 17 years old. Introduced to the game by his older brother who taught him to exploit women in different fashions, from prostitution to petty thieves, which he defines as a booster.
Always 8-9 girls deep. And I had to do nothing. I had boosters, I had prostitution going on, I had drug selling, I had whatever that you could do, you know what I'm saying? Whatever I could, you know, ease you in. If you was a booster, I had a girl that you can go boosting with. If you was hoeing, I had a girl you can go hoe with. So that was always my trade.
My name is Maria Edgar. I am currently in school pursuing my master's in social work.
Maria Edgar is a member of the STEP Project. She comes into San Quentin volunteering her time and sharing her personal story of being a survivor of sex trafficking.
When I was a young girl, underage, I was introduced into what they call the life, and I was, what I know now, trafficked across California and Nevada. I was forced to sell my body and image and different sexual acts to create some type of income for myself and for the man that I was with at the time.
There's a lot of reasons why women stay in those situations, but primarily, it's a form of mental bondage that enslaves some victims, preventing them from leaving.
I didn't stay for any more reasons than I didn't have anywhere else to go at the time. I had already moved out of my friend's place, and I was underage, so I couldn't get my own place.
As a victim of trafficking, Maria endured physical and emotional abuse. She now advocates for more options to prevent others from falling prey to the life.
You know, it's not just the children, it's the parents. Like, it's a whole circle, the teachers. Everyone has to be watching out for these children. And things that need to be implemented is prevention and education. There's a lot of programs that are doing this now, are putting out more education.
And some of that burden of prevention and education needs to be taken on by perpetrators, says STEP member Miguel C. Fuentes.
It's part of that responsibility we have as offenders and as these advocates we're trying to become for the victims of our crimes. With that comes a responsibility to utilize all the knowledge that we've gained, unfortunately, through manipulating and exploiting our victims. The responsibility is to use that knowledge to prevent future such crimes.
William Hearns believes that there are some misconceptions about the life.
What people get it wrong at is because they think that you're making them do this. I think that, you know, you're going over the boundaries now. I got nieces, a bunch of nieces, and I think if they ever told me that somebody making them do something, I would kill him. And I think if I had your sister out there and I'm making her do something, and she came and told you that I'm making her do something, you would kill me too. That's how I feel. But if she going freely because she want to go, that's on her.
18-year-old Daquan Moffitt has similar thoughts. A young man that should be graduating from high school, except he's exposed to the worst that humanity has to offer. And now he's in prison.
Choices. Everybody got choices. Talk about it. We can tell people that we got to make a change. The fact of the matter is, it's the world so big, people going to do it regardless. They going to do it just because that's how the world works.
Daquan, William, and Ramon are not members of the STEP Project. It is the mentality of these men that myself and other members of the STEP Project are working to change by bringing awareness as well as education to these men in hopes of putting an end to the enslavement of those held in bondage by sex traffickers. From San Quentin State Prison, I'm Lewis A. Scott for SQPR.
The San Quentin Prison Report is a project between KALW and San Quentin Reporters. For more stories, go online to KALW.org, click Cross Currents. And while you're online, why don't you email us? Let us know how we're doing. Our email is news@KALW.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter @KALW. Our team includes Lisa Cantrell, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Jurgen Klem, Angela Johnston, Allison Levitsky, Casey Miner, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Syra Trejo. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liz Mack. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Zoe Keating. She's been accompanied here by a program on her laptop computer while she plays the cello. You can hear Zoe Keating with her laptop and cello on Wednesday night at SF Jazz Center starting at 7:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.